Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments to read today, so all of you people out there listening, please, I'm getting lonely in here. Would you send me some comments? I'd really appreciate it. And then also, you may wonder where the 60-plus panel is. We didn't have one last time. We didn't have one this time. Well, the 60-plus panel, what do we have left of it, is on vacation for a few weeks. So I still have to work, but I'm very happy to be working for all of you. So what I want to do for today's program, I want to continue discussing Winston Churchill as the statesman warrior, or you could say warrior statesman, whichever makes you happy. Now, on our last program, I showed you that Winston Churchill used his military career as a launching pad into his political career. Now, of course, he did this in the Churchillian way. And I don't know if that's actually a word, but I'm going to use it anyway. My producer, Josh Sloan, is looking at me like, he doesn't know. So, but anyway, we're going to use it anyway. He did it in a Churchillian way. And, of course, he did it with pizzazz, and he did it with style. And, you know, he also ticked a lot of people off. But anyway, we'll talk about this. But he believed that to get into politics, like we said last time, he couldn't go to Oxford because he didn't qualify. And I did make a mistake. His dad really wanted him to go to Eton. Now, Eton was the prep school for Oxford and Cambridge. He did go to Harrow before he went to Sandhurst. He didn't like Harrow either, but he did love Sandhurst because it was active and military-oriented and all that. So what he thought he needed to do is he needed to be in battles, and he needed to win medals of honor while fighting in the conflicts. Now, it's a little different at that time than it was at this time. Is he had the ability, he could pick his battles. And so what he did was, is he his mom and his dad, of course, his dad was dead probably by this time, but his mom was very influential with the top leaders in the military, and of course we've all know why. I mean, she was having a relationship with at least 10 of these leaders, and so she was able to get him in the right battles, in the right positions, so that he could have a war exploit. And then what he would do then is he would write these exploits, and they would publish them in of course the best newspapers in England. And what he did was, he actually built his public image this way. Now, this plan would have been unheard of today. I mean, that would be considered really bad for, a soldier to be out, fighting in the battles and then writing stories back to, newspapers in order to get not only money, which Winston got a lot of money actually for it, but he also got a lot of notoriety. So again, this brought a lot of criticism on Winston. And it is kind of interesting that he really did team up with his mother. And she was very successful at getting his writing published. And Paul Johnson tells us about this, and he talks about it again on page 12. This is early in the book. So I thought what I'd do is I'd just go ahead and read a quote to you from this. And it is kind of a fascinating story. So this is at the very, second paragraph on page 12. It says, Churchill really was a go-getter. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And even when he finally did get into politics, he was another go-getter. He always looked for opportunities. So Johnson writes, "No sooner commissioned into the army, Churchill, as we may now call him, began his plan of campaign to make himself famous, or at least conspicuous," and he actually did both, A soldier needs war, and Churchill needed it more than most, for he could turn war into words and into cash. And a lot of people don't know it, but Churchill was a wealthy man because of his writing. And he's written, as Johnson has said in the book, millions of words. It says, but if you sat still expecting wars to come to you, you might be starved of action. Now, it's amazing. Here he becomes this military, soldier, an active soldier, and yet it was a time that there was a time when the world was actually having a certain measure of peace. So he couldn't actually find the war. So he wasn't actually, the nation wasn't actually involved in war, but he had to go find him. So Johnson goes on to say, you had to go to the wars, and that became Churchill's policy. The 4th Hussars under Colonel Brabazon, a family friend, was ordered to India. But there was a handsome war going on in Cuba, where America had sympathy for insurgents. Brabazon's agreement was reluctantly secured, and Churchill and his mother pulled strings to get him to the front and arranged a contract with the Daily Graphic to publish his dispatches. By November 1895, he was already under fire as well as braving outbreaks of yellow fever and smallpox. Now, this is like great story. This is great information for newspapers. It sold newspapers, and it made Winston Churchill rich. So he goes on to say, for the first time, he wrote, I heard shots fired in anger and heard bullets strike flesh or whistle through the air. This recalls the famous description by George Washington first hearing bullets whistle in 1757. But, and please listen to this, but unlike Washington, Churchill did not find something pleasant in the sound. On the contrary, he learned to take cover. He was under fire, I calculate, about 50 times in the course of his life and never once hit by a bullet. He was not the only outsider who came to Cuba for experience. Theodore Roosevelt, his older contemporary, led a force of freebooters there. So Winston Churchill would go out, and with the help of his mother, he'd find the battles, and she'd get him the contracts to write it for newspapers. And so essentially he was making himself famous. Now, it's interesting. He did meet President Roosevelt, but Roosevelt did not like Churchill. They did not get on together, and you would think the two of them would, and maybe there was a little too much competition between both of them. Anyway, the other thing that Churchill realized is he needed to get medals, not only get into the battles, but then win medals, not only get the contracts with newspapers, but get medals. Now, when he was in Cuba, notice this, and Johnson continues, the Spaniards awarded Churchill their standard medal for officers, the Red Cross, which he gratefully received, his first medal, along with 25 guineas paid by the Graphic for 5 articles. Thus, the pattern of his life for the next 5 years was set, finding wars, getting special permission to visit or participate in them, reporting them for newspapers and in book form, and collecting medals. Once in India, he looked about him for action, but he was not idle while waiting for opportunities. And this is something about Winston Churchill that is really, you know, an important quality we all need to imitate. And in our last program on this book, we're going to talk about what we can really learn from the life of Winston Churchill and how we can apply it in our own lives. But one thing about Winston Churchill is in his early years, he hated education. But when he got into the military, he realized that he was not as educated as he could have been. So here's what Johnson says. He says he was conscious of his ignorance and begged his mother to send him big, important books. She did. The Indian Army Day began early, but there was a big gap in the middle when the sun was hottest. Most spent it in siesta. Churchill read. He devoured Macaulay's History of England and Gibbon. He also read Winwood Reade's atheistic tract, The Martyrdom of Man, which turned him into a lifelong free thinker and a critic of organized religion. Though he always conformed outwardly enough to avoid the label atheist, which might have been politically damaging. Now, we also know that Winston Churchill certainly did believe in God, and he certainly did believe also that there was a plan that God was working out on this earth, and he said that to the United States Congress. says he read everything of value he could get his hands on and forgot nothing he read. But there was always gaps he felt in his knowledge, which he eagerly filled when vital books were recommended to him. So you see, even after he got into the military, Churchill realized he still needed to educate himself. And that's really important for all of us, is we always need to be learning. And I know I'm trying to learn new things all the time. And even taking on this radio program, you know, a couple years ago was a new thing for me. So Winston then spent the next 5 years, we just kind of summarized this, you know, finding battles and finding medals. And, you know, it really was, you know, quite a 5 years of his life. The one I want to just kind of focus on, we mentioned this briefly, and this is this Boer War. And this seems to be the war or the battle that really got him the popularity he needed to launch himself into public life. And I'm skipping ahead to page 15 of the Johnson book. And I'm going to change the sentence here just a little bit. It says, last came South Africa, where he reported the Boer War for the Morning Post. Strictly speaking, he was a non-combatant, but during a Boer ambush of an armored train, he took an active part, characteristically directing operations to free the engine. He was captured, made a prisoner of war, escaped, had a hazardous journey through the Boer lines, with posters advertising a large reward for his recapture, and a rapturous welcome in Durban, where he found himself a hero. And so this is like back in the days of the wild, wild west of the United States, is there was, you know, all these posters out there wanting the head of Winston Churchill. So he was getting the notoriety he wanted. Says he then went back to the war in earnest, showing an extraordinary amount of physical energy. Before the Boers surrendered Johannesburg, Churchill contrived to tour the city on a bicycle, speeding up when he saw armed parties of the enemy. We tend to epitomize Churchill by his later sedentary existence. In youth, he was hyperactive. He was the hero and public school's fencing champion, and fencing is one of the most energetic of sports. In India, he played polo enthusiastically, being part of his regimental team, which won the All India Calcutta Cup, the supreme prize in those days. Much of the time in South Africa was spent on his tramping feet, wearing out a pair of boots in the process. He was among 30,000 men who marched in triumph to Pretoria, the Boer capital, led by a war balloon, which he compared in his Morning Post report to the pillar of cloud which led the hosts of Israel. So essentially, you know, he was not only doing this, he was writing it, and he really drew an awful lot of criticism from this. Now, on page 16, I'm not going to read it, but page 16 gives a list of all the medals that Churchill won, you know, during his exploits. And, you know, he actually had a great plan, and it actually became very successful because not long after the Boer War and his experiences there, he entered into politics. He actually was able to take his first step into the House of Commons. Let's go to page 16, and I just want to read you this last comment about, you know, the result of all of his efforts to be a soldier and a medal grabber. It says, Johnson says in the middle of the page, he had meanwhile taken his first steps in politics. He contested Oldham for the Tories in 1899 and won in the khaki election the following year. In all these rapid developments, he had accumulated a number of critics and even enemies, and a reputation for being brash, arrogant, presumptuous, disobedient, boastful, and a bounder. He was accused of abusing his position as a British officer and his civilian status as a journalist, and of breaking his word of honor as a war prisoner. Among the orthodox and right-thinking, the mention of this name raised hackles. On the other hand, he was the best-known man of his generation when he took the corner seat above the gangway in the House of Commons to make his maiden speech in February 1901. It was the seat occupied by his father for his resignation speech in 1886. He was barely 26, and it was not going bad. So that's the Winston Churchill that we have come to know. And he was very successful in, you know, getting ahead. militarily, and then that he used that to launch himself into politics. And really, that was a lot of things that Winston Churchill did in his life were very inventive, and a lot of people disagree with them, but a lot of them, very many of them, turned out. Okay, now let's skip ahead now to where we were the last time. And I was talking about, you know, his foresight in being able to anticipate what was happening in the world, and he knew World War I was going to come to England. And so, again, he wasn't just, let's say, a brash go-getter. I mean, he was a very, very intelligent man. And so what I want to do now is I want to move into this chapter called The Lessons of Failure. And this brings us up to the Battle of the Dardanelles. And this was one big lesson that Churchill actually came later to believe that he needed to actually have gone through this to prepare him for what he accomplished in World War II. And so it really is, I think, just an important chapter, you know, for us. And I might just go back and read just a little bit from, you know, page 43. Again, like last time, you know, he was, when we ended our last program, he had been made First Lord of the Admiralty. He knew that the war was coming with Germany. He knew the Kaiser. And so what he did is he really beefed up the Navy, even made, you know, started the Naval Air Force. And so he was getting ready. And this is what Johnson says about him before we get in, just before we get into this chapter on all the lessons he had to learn. He said, when war came, Churchill was ready, prepared psychologically and in every way for what he realized would be the biggest conflict in history. He was like a man who had long schooled himself for a job and was now told to do it. And he had got the vast machine for which he was responsible geared up too. The war in many ways proved a disaster for Churchill, but on his downfall, Lord Kitchener, who had been made chief warlord at the outset, reassured him, "There's one thing at least they can never take away from you. When the war began, you had the fleet ready." So this next period of Winston's life, and again, as I said before, we're going to have a special guest come in and talk to us about his political life. We skipped over that, and there's even more we need to skip over as we proceed in history. But Winston Churchill really did. He had great successes, but then he had also despairing failures. And, you know, that's something another part of his life that we can learn from. I mean, we are all going to make mistakes. It's, do we use those mistakes to learn important lessons and not repeat them? And, of course, you know, Winston was this amazing, he was an amazing student of history, and we need to also be the same. So let's move into this chapter now. And the battles that I want to talk about in World War I that he had to learn the most from were, there was a pre-battle at Antwerp and then the Dardanelles downfall. And so again, he was ready for the war, but essentially what Churchill had to learn is he had to learn a little bit more about politics, and he also had to learn that, you know, if you're going to, you must be able to use authority if you're going to win wars. And that was really a big, big problem in Britain at the time. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead to page 47 now. Notice this is what Johnson, how he opens it. And it's just some really great writing about Winston Churchill and really positive writing about him. And Johnson says, though Churchill entered the Great War readily, if not eagerly, we must remember he had warned in speech and print that it would be a catastrophe for humanity. He was the only one, apart from that brilliant prophet of the future, H.G. Wells, to predict its horrors so clearly. And they proved worse than either supposed. Indeed, the first of the two world wars proved the worst disaster in modern history, perhaps in all history, from which most of the subsequent problems of the 20th century sprang, and many of which continue fortissimo into the 21st. He saw all these tremendous events from a highly personal viewpoint and portrayed them vividly, seen from close quarters and invested with strong emotion. And so we have to see Winston Churchill's, really his prophetic skills in terms of how to analyze world situations. Now, he did write a 4-volume set of books called The World Crisis about World War I, and I have that set. I've never been able to really take the time to read it, but I understand it's just astounding, his analysis. Here's what he said about the war, and this was just this was found on one of his just a sheet of paper that he had written, and this is from his office. But listen to this. This is great writing by Winston Churchill. He said, "All of the horrors of all the ages were brought together, and not only armies, but whole populations were thrust into the midst of them." And so this is what he was experiencing during World War I. He goes on, "The mighty educated states involved conceived, not without reason, that their very existence was at stake. Neither peoples nor rulers drew the line at any deed which they thought could help them to win. Germany, having let hell loose, kept well in the van of terror, but she was followed step by step by the desperate and ultimately avenging nation she had assailed. Every outrage against humanity and international law was repaid by reprisals, then on a greater scale and of longer duration. No truce or parley mitigated the strife of the armies. The wounded died between the lines, the dead moldered into the soil. Merchant ships and neutral ships and hospital ships were sunk on the seas, and all on board left to their fate or killed as they swam. Every effort was made to starve whole nations into submission, without regard to age or sex. Cities and monuments were smashed by artillery bombs from the air and were cast down indiscriminately. Poison gas in many forms stifled or scarred the soldiers. Liquid fire was projected upon their bodies. Men fell from the air in flames or were smothered, often slowly, in the dark recesses of the sea. The fighting strength of armies was limited only by the manhood of their countries. Europe and large parts of Asia or Africa became one vast battlefield on which not only armies but entire nations broke and ran. When all was over, torture and cannibalism were the only two expedients that the civilized, scientific Christian states have been able to deny themselves, and they were of doubtful utility." So this is how Winston summed up World War I. So really the world was just totally unprepared for what was coming. And what he had to experience during World War I is that people didn't even want to listen to him, but yet he could see what was coming. Now, he got very frustrated about what to do during World War I because there was just so much evil. And, of course, Flanders Field is one of the famous battles. And so what I think I'll do is I'll go ahead and break at this point, and we are running out of time for this program. But we'll come back to this in our next program. So, again, looks like we're out of time for today's program. So next time, we'll just continue our discussion of Winston Churchill, the warrior statesman. And remember, we are quickly approaching the second book in this series, also by Paul Johnson. The book is titled George Washington, Founding Father. You can find this book on Amazon for about $13 for Prime members. You can also find a used copy of the book for around $4 at abebooks.com. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.